Thank you, Ralph. I feel rather at home giving a talk organized by the Heinrich Böll Foundation, because offhand I can remember speaking at Böll Foundation talks organized in Washington, Beijing, maybe Brussels, maybe Bonn, and probably a few other places I can't remember offhand, but I appreciate very much your organizing this session tonight. Lest you become too impressed with Ralph's introduction, let me tell you about my biggest mistake. I'm far enough along in career now I can look back and identify the big ones. Interestingly, it occurred when the German environment minister was coming to Washington. I think it might have been in late 96, early 97. And her office had called ahead of time and asked for a meeting, and we said we'd be delighted to. So late one afternoon, I went over to the Watergate Hotel where she was staying. It was probably 4:30 or so. And we had a discussion for an hour and a half, maybe close to 2 hours, very informal. But really engaging the issues and just having a great discussion. And a few weeks later, I got a letter from her suggesting that maybe we should do a book together on global environmental issues. But at the time, I was doing the State of the World report, which is an annual, and also the second annual we started, Vital Steins, and I was working on still another book. So the idea of a fourth project I knew would just push me over the edge. So I wrote back and politely declined. But now that Angela Merkel is Chancellor of Germany, I thought maybe I would get that letter out again and say, you remember that idea you had? I take some consolation in the fact, Ralph, that if in fact we had done a book together, she might not be Chancellor of Germany today. Late last summer, as we were coming down the home stretch and researching and writing Plan B 3.0, indeed it was about this time of the year, you may remember in late August and early September, there was a flurry of reports on ice melting. Excuse me, I remember one in particular on the melting of Arctic sea ice. And it pointed out that in a period of 1 week, an area the size of the United Kingdom had disappeared. And scientists were staggered by this because the Arctic sea ice had been melting very gradually, and suddenly a big part of it just disappeared in a matter of days. And then we had a report from the Greenland ice sheet, in particular looking at the Ilulissat Glacier, which is on the southwest coast. It's one of the glacial outflows from the Greenland ice sheet. And normally, these glaciers move at 100 meters, 200 meters a year, something of that order of magnitude. This glacier was moving at 2 meters an hour. I mean, you literally could watch it move. And again, scientists had never seen anything like this before. And partly it was not only because of the rapid melting on the surface of the ice sheet, but a lot of the ice melt, the water was running down through cracks and lubricating the glacier underneath. So it was just flowing much faster than had ever been recorded. And the risk here, of course, is that if the Greenland ice sheet goes, and that's now a distinct possibility, then we're looking at a rise in sea level of 7 meters. And last year, we also were getting reports from the from China and from India about the melting of glaciers in the mountains there. The IPCC reports that the melting of the ice sheets, of the glaciers in the Himalayas, is the fastest of the ice melting anywhere in the world. The melting and potential disappearance of glaciers on the Tibetan Plateau and in the Himalayas. These are the glaciers whose ice melt sustains the flow of the major rivers of Asia during the dry season, the Ganges, the Indus, the Yangtze, the Yellow River, and so forth. Many of these glaciers could be gone in a matter of decades. Indian scientists are now talking about the possibility that the Gangotri Glacier, the huge glacier that feeds the Ganges, could disappear entirely at some time in the future. If it does, the Ganges becomes a seasonal river, flowing during the rainy season but not during the dry season. The Yellow River faces a similar risk. What we're looking at here is a situation where the disruption of river flows could disrupt food production in Asia. In northern India, large parts of China, we now have double cropping, often winter wheat and summer rice. But to sustain that double cropping, you have to have irrigation water pretty much the year round. We have never had such a massive projected threat to world food security as we now have in the melting of the glaciers in the Himalayas and on the Tibetan Plateau. Keep in mind, China's world's number one wheat producer, India's number two, the U.S. is number three. With rice, China and India totally dominate the world rice harvest. I think there's a tendency in the United States to not worry about those glaciers on the Tibetan Plateau. That's China's problem. Those glaciers on the Tibetan Plateau and what happens to them affect every one of us, because the world food economy is an integrated food economy today. There's one price of wheat, one price of rice, one price of corn or soybeans. Shortages in China would affect the entire world. One of the things that concerns me is the growing number of failing states in the world. In each of the last several years, the number of failing states in the world has increased. And my concern is that in addition to the current stresses on governments, particularly in developing countries like rapid population growth, water shortages, deforestation, soil erosion, we now have some new stresses. One is peak oil, soaring oil prices, and the other is rising food prices. We may well have crossed from a period of relative agricultural abundance over the last half century to one of shortages and of scarcity. With peak oil, some geologists think it was last year, but whether it was last year or a few years from now doesn't make too much difference. Peak oil is on our doorstep, and the thing that sort of nailed this was the announcement by the Russians a few months ago when they said that their oil production, Russia being now the world's largest oil producer, their oil production, they said, peaked in the last quarter of last year, and they expect it to gradually decline from here on. Once we pass peak oil, no country gets more oil unless another gets less. And this will be a world very different, the one that we have known throughout our lifetimes, because always over the last century, world oil production has been rising. I mean, there's been an occasional dip here and there, but basically, we've spent our lives in a world where oil production is increasing. Now, very soon, we will be spending the rest of our lives in a world where oil production is declining. It will be a very different world, and we're not at all well prepared for it. One reason we're not well prepared is because the IEA, that the world sort of looks to for projections, uses a rather unique method for projecting world oil supply and demand. The technique they use is to look at population growth, to look at incomes, and project the demand for oil. That's a fairly straightforward process. But then they assume that supply will satisfy demand. And so they use that technique because it has worked in the past. But there comes a point when it doesn't work anymore, and I think we've reached that point. I doubt very much that world oil production will go much higher than it is today. My concern is that the number of failing states will continue to increase, and then we have to ask the question, at what point do failing states lead to a failing global civilization? We don't know the answer to that question. We've not been there before. This is uncharted territory. Plan B is a response to this threat, to try to alleviate the stresses that are building. It has four principal components. One is stabilized climate. The second is stabilize population. The third, eradicate poverty, and those two go closely together. And the fourth is to restore the natural support systems that underpin the world economy, and particularly the agricultural sector. That means soils and grasslands and aquifers and forests and fisheries and so forth. Right now, they're all in a state of decline. And we know from earlier civilizations that no civilization has survived the continuing decline of its natural support systems. Nor will we. So this is one of the big challenges. In looking at cutting carbon emissions, stabilizing climate, we did not ask the question that political leaders normally ask, which is, how much of a cut in carbon emissions is politically feasible? We asked other questions. We asked, how much and how fast do we have to cut carbon emissions if we want to have a decent chance to save the Greenland ice sheet? How fast do we have to cut carbon emissions if we want to try to save at least the larger of the mountain glaciers in Asia? When you ask those questions, then it becomes clear that the goal of cutting carbon emissions 80% by 2050, which is what most political leaders think of as a goal, is simply not adequate. Time is going to run out long before then. Plan B calls for cutting carbon emissions 80% by 2020. And this is close to a wartime mobilization. But we're in that kind of a situation. For decades now, we've been talking about the need to save the planet. But what's really at stake is civilization itself. I mean, we use the term, the rather unexciting term of sustainable development, to describe our goals and what we're trying to do. But the alternative to sustainable development is unsustainable development, or eventual decline and collapse. And that's the trail we're on. We have not yet moved the world economy onto a sustainable path. That is the challenge. In cutting carbon emissions 80%, we look to three ways of cutting carbon emissions. One is systematically raise the energy efficiency of the world economy. The second is a massive shift to renewable sources of energy. And the third is banning deforestation and planting billions of trees to sequester carbon. Let me just give one example of the first component, that is raising efficiency. If worldwide, thank you, I'm going to talk about water shortly. if worldwide we're to shift to the most efficient lighting technologies, which for most of the world would be compact fluorescent bulbs. We can cut global electricity use by 12%. That means we could close 705 of the nearly 2,400 coal-fired power plants in the world today. Roughly 40% of the world's electricity now comes from coal. Let me talk about renewables. Things are beginning to happen with the development of renewable energy in various parts of the world that are extraordinarily exciting. In the United States, for example, the state of Texas, which for the last century has been our leading source of oil, is now our leading generator of electricity from wind, having eclipsed California 2 years ago. The state of Texas now has over 5,000 megawatts of generating capacity and plans to move that up to over 20,000 megawatts. But also in development, in various independent projects in Texas, is enough to take it up to about 45,000 megawatts over the next several years, including a fair amount of coastal development of wind power, for example. 45,000 megawatts. Germany's current wind electric generation is about 25,000 megawatts. This is Germany, who knows? About 25? Yeah. So this is big. This is a state of Texas with 24 million people. 45,000 megawatts would satisfy the residential electricity needs of the 24 million people who live in Texas easily. One of the major investors is an oil man. His name is T. Boone Pickens. He's legendary in the oil community. I think he's 81 years old now. He is investing $10 billion of his personal fortune in a 4,000-megawatt wind farm in the Texas Panhandle. Huge, a huge shift of oil money into renewable energy. Someone asked him why he, an oil man, someone who'd been in the oil business for 60 years, was suddenly investing all this money in wind energy. And he said very simply, I've gotten tired of oil depletion curves. And the basic point underlying that response was that when you invest in a new oil field, it'll last for maybe several decades, and then the yields begin to decline. If you invest in a coal mine, the seams eventually run out and you have to start over again. But when you invest in wind farms in Texas and the infrastructure, the transmission lines to get the power to the major load centers, to use the industry term, you're investing in an energy system that can last as long as the Earth itself. I mean, sure, you have to replace the bearings in the turbines from time to time. There's certain maintenance associated with it. But for the first time since the Industrial Revolution began, we are now beginning to invest in energy systems that will basically last forever. This is exciting. I talked about Texas. I could talk about other projects in the U.S., a 5,000-megawatt wind farm under development in South Dakota. It will feed electricity into the Chicago area and the Midwestern industrial heartland. I could talk about offshore wind farm in the state of Delaware, enough to satisfy 40% of the state's electricity needs, 600-megawatt wind farm in the planning stages. Wyoming, another multi-billionaire from Colorado, made his money in information technology, is building a 2,000-megawatt wind farm and investing in a 900-mile transmission line, 1,300-plus kilometers from Wyoming to California. You don't build a 900-mile transmission line for just 2,000 megawatts, but there are going to be many wind farms in Wyoming where there's a lot of wind, a lot of cattle, and very few people. So most of the electricity generated there on the wind farms will go in the state of California, which now has nearly 40 million people. I could go on with examples, but we're suddenly beginning to see huge amounts of private capital moving into renewable energy. Here in Europe, a discussion now underway between a Scottish government agency and two investment funds in the Middle East. I think they're both based in Dubai. To fund a $7 billion network of transmission lines off the eastern coast of Scotland that will link to Europe proper. 60,000 megawatts. I mean, the UK's total generating capacity today is less than 100,000 megawatts. And we used to look at transmission as a barrier to developing wind and solar and other resources. Now suddenly investors are seeing it as an investment opportunity. Things are beginning to change. They're changing very fast. In the United States, or let me back up, when we talk about cutting carbon emissions worldwide by 80%, people say, well, what about cars in the United States? And that's a good question because the U.S. consumes as much gasoline as the next 20 countries combined. Now, that sounds like it might be a mistake, but unfortunately, it's not. We have, I think, 28% of the world's cars. We drive them, on average, much further than the rest of the world, and they are much less fuel efficient than those in the rest of the world. So that really pushes up our share of world gasoline consumption. Let me just back up and say that in 2020, we see 40% of the world's electricity coming from wind farms. And in our plan, which is a fairly detailed plan, this is not a back-of-the-envelope calculation, we see we're planning to back out all coal-fired power plants. All coal-fired power plants. In the U.S., we now have two new technologies converging to create that will enable us to create an entirely new automotive fuel economy. One is gas electric hybrid cars, and once you get hybrid cars, it's just a short step to plug-in hybrids. There are now four companies coming to market with plug-in hybrids, and with advanced design wind turbines, producing low-cost wind energy, we'll be able to run our cars on wind-generated electricity at the gallon of gasoline equivalent cost of less than $1. Less than $1 per gallon of gasoline. And this could happen quickly. Right now, the race is underway between Toyota and GM to see who gets to the market first. My guess is that both have said they're going to be in the market in 2010. My guess is that Toyota is going to make it in 2009 with a plug-in version of the Prius, the hybrid that's already on the road. And there are about 500,000 of them on the road in the U.S., many more in the U.S. than here, or indeed than in Japan. So we're looking at a Prius, and a few hundred people have already converted their Priuses into plug-ins. You just buy a second storage battery, and then literally an extension cord, so you can plug it in to a wall socket and recharge the batteries. With that, a Prius, which normally gets 46 miles per gallon, goes up over 100 miles per gallon. The Chevrolet Volt, which is a somewhat different design, the Chevrolet Volt is essentially an electric car, but it has an auxiliary gasoline engine that drives a generator to recharge the batteries when they drop below a certain level. But the all-electric range with the Volt is about 40 miles. So for the typical daily commuting, you would never use gasoline. You would just use electricity from the recharge, plugging it in overnight. The other interesting thing is that if you recharge overnight, study by the U.S. government-sponsored study points out that we could convert our entire fleet of automobiles to plug-in hybrids, and 70% of them could be recharged from the existing grid just by using off-peak power. So the great thing about plug-in hybrids is you don't need a new infrastructure. I mean, you need a few modifications, some plug-in places at work, maybe in parking lots and parking garages, if you have a longer commute and want to recharge during the day. But this is entirely within reach now. And what I'm hoping is that we'll see a crash program to develop. And Barack Obama has said he wants to push hard with plug-in hybrids. He understands the potential. I've been talking about wind. Let me just give one example of solar energy, and that's Algeria. Algeria, as you know, has long been an oil exporter, but the Algerians know they will not be exporting oil indefinitely, and they want to keep exporting energy. So they look at the desert in Algeria as a source of solar thermal generated electricity that they will then ship to Europe via undersea cable. They're looking at 6,000 megawatts. They point out that they have enough harnessable solar energy in their desert, which is most of the country, to power the world economy. Again, it sounds like a mistake, but it's not. I mean, another version of that point is that the solar energy striking the earth in 1 hour is enough to run the world economy for 1 year. So it's not a shortage of solar energy. The challenge is to work out the economics of harnessing it and getting the electricity to where people can use it. Geothermal. Almost no growth for the last few decades. Now, suddenly, a lot of things are happening. There are 94 geothermal projects in various stages of development and construction, geothermal power plants, in the western U.S. states right now. But the big one is Indonesia, which announced a few weeks ago it's going to develop 6,800 megawatts of wind. Of geothermal generating capacity. Indonesia has maybe 500 volcanoes, 131 of which are active. They have a lot of heat close to the surface. I think their total generating capacity might be 35,000 megawatts. So 6,800 megawatts of geothermal is a lot. And here again, the interesting thing is that the lead agency in developing this is Pertamina, which is the state oil company. It's responsible for developing 4,000 out of the 6,800 megawatts. This is interesting because it's the first major shift of resources within an oil company from oil to renewable energy. Indonesia's oil production peaked some years ago. It is no longer an oil exporter. It is a net oil importer. And what they're doing is shifting resources from oil to geothermal energy. They have enough geothermal energy. One of about 40 countries in the world has enough geothermal potential to power the entire economy. I mentioned wind in the US. To put that resource into perspective, the Department of Energy points out that three states, North Dakota, Kansas, and Texas, have enough harnessable wind energy to satisfy national electricity needs. So we have 47 other states and an offshore potential, which by itself could supply 70% of US electricity consumption. So it's not a limitation on the scale of the resource. We've got the resources in the world. China probably has wind resources very similar to that of the US. China can double its current electrical generating capacity from wind alone. So the challenge is not the resources. We have them, whether it's geothermal or solar or wind, but how to harness them and get them into the market. How do we get from here to there? If I were to pick one policy initiative, it would be restructuring the tax system, lowering income taxes, raising the carbon tax. One can achieve the same goal with cap and trade, and we'll probably end up using a combination of both, but if I had to choose, I would choose restructuring the tax system. Most economists would opt for that. How fast can we restructure the world energy economy? Probably much faster than we now realize. I think with each passing year, we're going to see more and more evidence of the long-term effects, the long-term consequences of climate change. Ice melting is one facet of that change. Rising sea level would be another. From time to time, I go back and read the economic history of World War II. And I go back to President Roosevelt's State of the Union address, January 6, 1942, 1 month after the Japanese attack on Pearl Harbor. In that State of the Union address, he said, we're going to produce 45,000 tanks, 60,000 planes, 20,000 anti-aircraft and artillery guns, several thousand ships. People were staggered by these numbers. The U.S. economy was still coming out of the Depression. There was a lot of skepticism as to whether those goals could possibly be reached. But what Roosevelt and his colleagues realized was that at that time, the largest concentration of industrial power in the world was in the U.S. automobile industry, because even during the Depression, we were making 2 or 3 million cars a year. So after his State of the Union address, he called in the leaders of the industry, the automobile industry, and he said, because you guys represent such a large share of our industrial capacity, we're going to rely heavily on you to help us reach these arms production goals. And they said, well, Mr. President, we're going to do everything we can, but it's going to be a real stretch, producing cars and all these arms too. He said, you don't understand. We're going to ban the sale of private automobiles in the United States. And that's exactly what happened. From the beginning of April 1942 until the end of 1944, there were essentially no cars made in the United States. The entire industry converted to arms production. And in the end, we exceeded every one of those arms production goals. We produced not 60,000 planes, but 129,000 planes, fighters, bombers, reconnaissance planes, cargo transport, troop transport. Even today, thinking of producing 129,000 planes is extraordinary. But the point, the underlying point here is this. It did not take decades to restructure the U.S. industrial economy. It didn't take years. It was done in a matter of months. If we could do it then, we can do it now. I think we can restructure the world energy economy to cut carbon emissions dramatically, much faster than we now realize, if we understand the nature of the threat that the world is facing. Climate change could be so enormously disruptive. I mean, if the Greenland ice sheet were to go, the West Antarctic ice sheet will almost certainly go. The two together would raise sea level 12 meters or so, nearly 40 feet. Imagine several hundred million rising sea refugees, probably 700 million. Imagine the stresses people being forced to move by rising sea level. We're facing enormous challenges, and I don't think we've yet grasped fully the seriousness of the issues we're facing. And I think it's partly because we keep asking the question, you know, what do we think we can do? What's politically feasible? And we're not thinking on a scale that's responsive to the scale of the threat that we're facing. Amory Lovins, who's sort of an energy guru in the United States, probably known to many of you, was being interviewed by Elizabeth Colbert, a writer for New Yorker magazine. And she was doing a profile of Amory, and she asked Amory about thinking outside the box. Amory responded, "There is no box. There is no box." And that's where we need to be today. We're all so circumscribed by our experiences, by our training, our education. We've got to think beyond where we've been before and what we've done up until now. And no longer, this is not a time for incremental marginal thinking. This is a time for quantum jump thinking on a large scale. And this is our challenge. We're in a race between tipping points, between natural tipping points and political tipping points. Can we close coal-fired power plants fast enough to save the Greenland ice sheet? Can we cut carbon emissions fast enough to save at least the larger glaciers in the Himalayas and on the Tibetan Plateau? Those are the issues that we're facing. And my final point, I think I'm very close to my 40 minutes, Ralph. My final point is that saving civilization, which is what I think we're challenged with, is not a spectator sport. It's not something where we sit around and hope someone else is going to do it. We all have a stake in the future. If not our own lives, certainly our children or grandchildren. It means becoming politically active. As I travel about the world and people say, well, what can I do? And they expect me to say, well, recycle your newspapers and change your light bulbs and so forth. And those things are important. But we have to change the system now. We've got to accelerate the process of change. We've got to fasten a response that's commensurate with the scale of the threat that we're facing. We're not close to that now at the political level. It means not just voting in elections, important though that obviously is. It also means picking an issue and going to work on it. One of the most active ones in the U.S. now that's gotten thousands of recruits in the last 18 months is the powerful grassroots opposition to new coal-fired power plants. That's an issue, a tangible one you can work on. Or a world-class recycling program. I mean, Germany's on the cutting edge anyhow, but we can do better. Or what about plug-in hybrids as an option? And what about restructuring urban transport systems? That's not so much a challenge here, that's a challenge in the United States and other parts of the world. If you like challenges, this is a great time to be in the environmental movement. Ralph, thank you very much. Yes.